Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be where you are in the know. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for tonight's program. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or download our iPhone or Android app for program and schedule information, as well as podcasts of programs. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. David Kennedy is Professor Emeritus of History at Stanford University and Director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. His work is distinguished by its blend of economic and cultural analysis with social and political history. He's authored a number of critically acclaimed books, textbooks, and nonfiction books, and has been a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize and winner of the 2000 Pulitzer Prize in History for his book, History for Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, 1929 to 1945. He's also editor of the Oxford History of the United States. Please join me in welcoming Professor David Kennedy to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you very much, John, and thanks to all of you for your interest in this subject and for being here this evening. I'm well aware of the old maxim that it's wrong to judge a book by its cover, but I'm going to invite you to join me in violating that maxim, and I want to dwell just for a moment on the dust jacket cover of this book for a particular reason. You probably can't see it very well in the back of the room, but the cover consists of three panels. The largest and middle panel simply is the title of the book, The Modern American Military, and the editor's name, that's me. The top panel is a photograph of what most people, when they first see it, will probably think is a Predator drone. That's what I thought it was when they first showed me the photograph, but it's actually something called an RQ-4 Global Hawk. It's a long-distance, high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft. It is remotely piloted, so it is, in the popular parlance, a drone. And it is designed eventually to replace the U-2, the warhorse airplane of the Cold War era that did that kind of long-distance surveillance. And the bottom panel I'm particularly fond of because it shows a group of Marines doing calisthenics at Paris Island, and if you look closely, you'll see they're all women. The two images, I think, top and bottom of the cover, make a very strong statement about one of the important themes of this book, and indeed I would say it's probably the motivating idea that prompted the 15 of us who've contributed to this book to undertake the project, is to make the point that this is not your grandfather's army, it's not your daddy's armed forces. We've had since 1943 a wholly different force from what most of us carry around in our heads as our legacy image of who our armed forces are and what they do and how they do it. So that's probably the single greatest overarching theme of this collection of essays in the book, is that we're trying to increase public awareness in civil society about just how different today's military is from the militaries that we've had in the past. The other theme, a big theme that runs through all of the essays, is that not only are we in civil society pretty unfamiliar with the military that we have, but also most, if not all, of the authors in the book work the theme of the worrisome separation between the civilian and military sectors. It's something I think on a moment's reflection we're all aware of at some level. But this book tries to bring that intuitive idea up to a higher level of consciousness and to inform it with some data. In just a moment, I'll say something about what has driven this widening gap and chasm even between the civil and military sectors. But let me just also say in a summary way that we think, all the authors in this volume think, there are at least three levels of worry about the nature of the force we have and its relationship to civil society. The first concern has to do with political accountability when it comes to the decision to use military force to coerce another society to our way of thinking. The second worry has to do with social equity or fairness in the area of who serves in our armed forces today. And the third, a little less easy to define, but the third area of worry we think is what we call social comity. That is not just accountability and fairness, but the implications of the military we have for the tranquility and, I would dare say, the good manners of our relations with each other in this society. Now, if I can borrow from 1 Corinthians, all three of these abide: accountability, equity, and comity. But the greatest of these is accountability. And that's the theme that is most salient in the several essays in this book. And I'll try to dilate a little bit on that right now by giving you some of the flavor of this collection. Broadly speaking, we think there have been three developments in history in the last 40 years or so, since we transitioned to the all-volunteer force in the wake of the Vietnam era in 1973. Three developments that have driven this chasm wider and wider between us in civil society and the military. The first is quite simply and basically the fact that we went to an all-volunteer force in 1973, so that today, and this has been true for 40 years, no citizen is obliged to serve. There is no obligation to service, military service in our society today. That is a huge departure from our historic traditions, and I'll come back to that point. The second, and that's the foundational fact that underlies all of this, is that an all-volunteer force is just that. It's volunteer, and it relieves civil society in general of a sense of civic duty and obligation to shoulder arms or take up some of the burdens of military service. The second development, again, is fairly familiar, I suppose, on a moment's reflection. It has to do with the role of technology in transforming the nature of the force from what it was in an earlier era. And again, I'll talk about that, the implications of that in just a moment, but just to highlight where I'm going, technology has enabled us as a society to field a force that is at one and the same time extraordinarily lethal in its capacities, also extraordinarily small with respect to its relationship to the civil population that we have, 310 million people or so. And it's also a force that is, in the greater scheme of things, relatively inexpensive. So lethal, small, and inexpensive are characteristics of the force that have been enabled, you might say, by modern-day technologies. And the third thing that has happened to our military, this a little more recently, let's say in the last 10 years especially, is the expansion of its missions beyond just force-on-force contact with an adversary and the mission to prevail. Both the Iraq and Afghan wars have compelled the military to do things quite out of the ordinary for a force that historically has been trained, equipped, and so on, to meet a more or less comparable enemy force in the field and prevail over it. We've done a lot of nation-building things that entail all kinds of jobs that the military had not anticipated doing before 2003 or 2001, and that have immensely dilated the scope of the military's operational sphere. So we have this, at one and the same time, therefore, we're confronting a force today, if we look at it carefully, that has enormous power and lethality, but is less and less accountable and comprehensible to civil society as a whole. That is as close as I can get to a summary theme that runs through all of the 13 major essays and two lesser ones in the book. So I might just say a word about how I came to this topic, to take an interest in this topic. Ultimately, my interest in this stemmed from an undergraduate course I was teaching at Stanford some years ago, and one of the students in the course was actually the spouse of what we call at Stanford a National Security Fellow, an Army colonel who was spending a year at Stanford. For him and others like him, it's the equivalent of going to one of the war colleges. It's a way to upgrade their skills in a civil institution like Stanford so they can be better officers. And the spouse of this colonel was in my class, and she was after me all quarter long in the course to say more about the military. So in the very last lecture of the course, I said a few things about the military and what its likely future was. And for the first time in 10 weeks of the course, she came up afterwards to the podium and thanked me. She had not been thanking me the previous 10 weeks. She'd been badgering me But on this occasion, she thanked me. Well, I thought, well, if what I said was that cogent or whatever it was that made that impression on her, maybe I should find a broader audience. So I wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times that appeared in 2005. John Diaz maybe will appreciate this. I did what I thought was good journalistic practice, but it turned out to be very bad tactics diplomatically and politically. I opened with the sentence, "The United States now has a mercenary army." Good journalistic lead, but really a pretty sharp poke in the eye with a sharp stick to a lot of readers. And that piece, I've written a lot of opinion pieces in various formats over the years, and I've never, ever had a reaction like that one. And I do think most of the people that react, it was a very hostile reaction, very angry, and I think most of it had to do with the use of that word mercenary. It was right there in the first sentence. I think a lot of people that got in touch with me hadn't read beyond the first sentence, but they were very angry indeed. So I thought, well, maybe I need to seek a way to expand on my remarks and clarify what I meant. I blamed it all on the New York Times format. You know, they only give you 800 words for an opinion piece as a rule. And what I really should have said was that the United States now has an armed force whose composition and configuration tempts the political leadership to treat it as if it were a mercenary force. But as John Diaz will know, that would be a terrible lead, and nobody would read on, and the whole thing would have just gone clunk. But that was essentially my point. In any case, I began to look for other ways to kind of set the record straight about what I really thought about this, and I published a somewhat longer essay in the Bulletin of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and that led to an invitation to edit a volume of Daedalus, which is the Journal of the American Academy on this theme. And then that special edition of Daedalus, about now a year and a half ago, transitioned finally into this book from Oxford University Press on the modern American military. So that's the background of how I got here. In the course of this, I was invited in the summer of 2008 to be an observer at an Army ROTC encampment at Fort Lewis, Washington, now called Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It's an annual exercise where they bring some 6,000-plus Army ROTC cadets to Fort Lewis for a five-week course of leadership training. I was there for 1 week to observe them. They're young men and women between their junior and senior year in college, and this is their last summer before they graduate at the end of the following academic year, and then go on to be commissioned as military, in this case, Army officers. And in the course of that week that I was there, I spent a lot of time with the senior instructors, colonels and generals by and large, and I heard at least a dozen times over the course of the week a version of the following question. It's in 2008 now. And people would say, "Can you explain to me, Professor, how it is that the Army is at war and the country is not?" And that, again, is probably the central question that animated a lot of our work on this project, is how can there be, how have we evolved the military establishment to the place where that kind of question is even thinkable? That the armed forces can be in harm's way and buried in the burden of service, and the society at large really is not much disturbed or concerned by the nature of the force and the uses to which it's put. So let's just talk a bit about the demography of the force, which is one of the major themes in this book. Several of the essays address it. When I was there at Fort Lewis, the general officers, brigadier generals and above, one star and up, in the Army had just finished a few weeks earlier some kind of regular poll or questionnaire that they do amongst their ranks just to take their temperature and share attitudes and so on. And among the things that they had discovered in this poll, that of the 307 general officers in the United States Army at that time, 307, one star and above, they had 180 of their children in service. 307 generals, 180 of their children in uniform. And they spoke of this, they were proud of it, and they spoke of it with pride, but they also spoke of it, I could not help but detect, with some element of anxiety. Because those numbers bespeak the fact that we are in danger of long-term establishment of an intergenerationally self-perpetuating separate military caste. I thought this was a sufficiently interesting and indeed alarming set of numbers that I came back to Stanford that summer and put my graduate student research assistant on the task of trying to determine how many children of the 535 elected members of the United States Congress, 100 in the Senate, 435 in the House of Representatives, of those 535 people, how many of their children were in service, and the answer was 10. So, again, the numbers, I think, suggest just on their face a pretty worrisome matter. 307 generals with 180 children in service, 535 federally elected representatives and senators with 10 children in service. It's just a proxy for the general issue we're trying to get at here about the difference between the military and civilian sectors. It's also the case that as recently as 1970 in the Vietnam era, approximately 70% of the members of Congress at that time had themselves had some military experience. Today, only about 20% do. So the political decision-making class, our legislators, have less and less direct experience of who the military are and what they do, and very, very few of their children are sent into harm's way. We have a volunteer force, and precisely because it's a volunteer force, it is not representative of the population as a whole. I can give you some very specific numbers on that. The relevant comparison or unit of analysis is the civilian labor force cohort between the ages of 18 and 44, the standard age brackets for military service. And in that labor force cohort between the ages 18 and 24, men and women alike, African Americans make up about 12% of that cohort in civil society at large, but they make up 19% of the armed forces. So African Americans are rather significantly overrepresented in the military force. Hispanics make up about 17% of the 18 to 44-year-old labor force cohort, but only about 12% of the armed forces. So Hispanics are pretty significantly underrepresented in the composition of the force. And if you want to extend this another step, although this one is a little more controversial, I recognize, women make up 51% of the 18 to 44-year-old age cohort in the labor force, but only 14% of the military. So, again, on the face of it, we have something to think about, that we do not have the kind of citizen army that we fielded in Vietnam, and even more to the point in World War II, the last war we remember as a good war, when the armed forces were made up of a vast 16 million people, almost all of them men, of course, whose demographic profile sharply resembled, if not was identical with, the relevant demographic profile in civil society. That simply is not the force that we have today. And I'll give you a couple of other intercepts on that same point. Admiral Michael Mullen, when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 2011, gave the commencement address at West Point. And here is what he said, part of what he said. He said, "There isn't a town or a city I visit where people do not convey to me their great pride in what we do." He's speaking out of West Point graduates. "But I fear they do not know us. This is important because a people uninformed about what they are asking the military to endure is a people inevitably unable to fully grasp the responsibilities our Constitution levies upon them. Were we more representative of the population, were more American families touched by military service, perhaps a more advantageous familiarity would ensue. But we are a small force, less than 1% of the population. We're also fairly insular, speaking our own language of sorts and living within our own unique culture." And indeed, living within their own unique culture, largely insulated from civil society on military bases, another distinguishing characteristic of today's force measured against its historical antecedents, is that a majority of enlisted personnel today are married. And they live with their families on military bases. They worship, go to school, shop, entertain themselves, and so on, in the confines of the military base, to a degree that simply wasn't true of conscript, mostly male single force, single male forces, warriors in the past. One further observation about this. This comes from another commencement address given at Duke University in 2010 by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. And he said the following. The propensity to serve, he said, is most pronounced in the South and the Mountain West and in rural areas and small towns nationwide, a propensity that well exceeds these communities' portion of the population as a whole. Concurrently, the percentage of the force from the Northeast, the West Coast, and major cities continues to decline. I am also struck by how many young troops I meet who grew up in military families and by the large number of our senior officers whose children are in uniform. So again, these aren't just my opinions. These are the opinions of senior military officials and the Secretary of Defense in Gates' case, who are also anxious about the nature of the force we have and its unrepresentative character. Let me talk briefly about technology and its role. The long and the short of it is that a lot of the information and navigation technologies that have evolved in the civilian sector in the last generation or so, many of them right here in our Bay Area and in Silicon Valley, have been taken into the military in ways that have tremendously amplified the firepower and fighting effectiveness of an individual soldier or airman or marine or sailor, so that we simply do not need as large a force to deliver the same amount of military punch in the field. And I can, again, give you some numbers about that. At the end of World War II, as many people in this room will probably know, the U.S. government organized something called the United States Strategic Bombing Survey. And it was a very systematic and scientific effort to try to answer the question, what role did air power play in the final victory over Germany and Japan? World War II is the first war in which air power really is a significant factor at all. And I won't bore you with the details, but there's one set of numbers that came out of this that's quite interesting. They calculated, the United States Strategic Bombing Survey investigators, that to destroy one target in the European theater of war, German, Nazi-occupied Europe, in World War II, on average, to certainly destroy a single target, took 108 aircraft dropping 648 gravity bombs. 108 aircraft, 648 bombs, on average, to certainly destroy a single target. On the first night of the American reprisal raids against Afghanistan, the Taliban strongholds in 2001 following 9/11, 38 aircraft destroyed 159 targets. Because technology had so advanced, especially on grounds of accuracy and precision, not just firepower or bomb load, but precision, precision, precision is the real revolutionary change. Had we had in 2001 the same technologies that we employed in World War II, in order to destroy those 159 targets in Afghanistan, we would have had to deploy 17,000 aircraft, dropping 140,000 gravity bombs. So again, it's just one way of capturing how drastically we have compressed the amount of manpower we need to field an equivalently powerful military force. And if we look at the economic dimension of this, the picture is very, very similar. World War II consumed at its height in 1943, 1944, 40-some percent of gross domestic product, or GDP. It claimed about 40% of the society's economic and fiscal resources. In the height of the Cold War, that number was in the 8 to 10 or 11% range. Vietnam War is at the lower end of that bracket, about 8%. Today, it's less than 5% of GDP is the Defense Department budget. And that includes the era of special appropriations for Iraq and Afghanistan. We have a $15 trillion economy. So even a $700 billion Defense Department budget is big in absolute numbers, to be sure, but it makes a very light weight on our economy as a whole at the $15 trillion level. So we have a force that is, to repeat, it's lethal, it's small, it's relatively inexpensive, it's all volunteer, and all of those things, I believe, feed this problem of accountability, and that's where I'd like to spend a few minutes that remain to me. Here again are some numbers just on the face of it that ought to be disturbing to you. They're certainly disturbing to me. In the 27 years between the end of World War II, or 28 years between the end of World War II and 1973, in all but one and a fraction of those years, we had a draft. So let's call it 27 years of draft, from 1945 to 1973. In all of that period, we as a society had 19 overseas military deployments. Since 1973, the all-volunteer force, we've had 144 overseas deployments. The big ones we're all familiar with, the first Gulf War, Iraq, Afghanistan, but there are lots of others. And again, just as a first-order approximation, it seems to me a reasonable question to ask, well, what changed from 19 deployments over a 27-year period to 144 deployments over a 40-year period? If you do the math, it's about a five-fold increase in the rate of deployment. There's plenty of room for argument about what those numbers mean, I should say, because some of the deployments were very brief and relatively small. But even if you discount it by a lot, there is some observable effect since 1973 in the propensity to use military force as an instrument of policy. And it seems to me what changed, especially, is the transition of the all-volunteer force and its rapid adaptation to military purposes of these technological changes that have driven changes in all of our lives, but especially having to do with accuracy of weapon systems and battlefield communication. So this is a worrisome set of developments that one maybe a little bit too provocative way to put this, but I'm going to do it anyway, is to say that we've created a force without fully intending to do so that has created a moral hazard for the political class, especially whoever happens to be the commander-in-chief, to use the force more frequently precisely because its use does not levy a personal, demographic, fiscal, or economic burden on civil society. What the remedy for this is a very, very difficult question or set of questions to address, but I think the problem of not only a chasm of misunderstanding between civil society and the military, but this problem of the mechanisms that historically have ensured and underwritten civilian political control over the military are also becoming less robust than they once were. George Washington, over 200 years ago, in 1783 to be exact, said the following. He said, "It may be laid down as a primary position and the basis of our system that every citizen who enjoys the protection of a free government owes not only a proportion of his property, but even of his personal services to the defense of it." That is decidedly not the situation we have today. The idea of the citizen-soldier is as old as the Greek and Roman republics. It was the basis of our system, as Washington said, from the inception of this independent democratic republic, and it prevailed down to 1973, and that is not the kind of force we have today. As I said earlier, no citizen is now obliged to serve, and we're in the peculiar position as a society that we can send into the field history's most lethal and destructive military force without breaking a sweat as a civil society. Now, I just think that's a structural situation that ought to invite our attention. For those of you who see the book, you might notice that in the frontispiece of it, I adopted a piece of wisdom that's even older than George Washington's. It's a little line from a book by Cicero about 2,000 years ago, a book called De Officiis, or On the Office, or On Responsibility of Office Holding, I suppose we'd translate it. And he said simply, "Parvi enim sunt foras arma, nisi est consilium domi." Would you like me to translate that? It simply says that the force of arms in the field is of little value without wise counsel at home. And again, it's just an ancient way of capturing the same point, that we need to pay attention to the quality of our wise counsel at home, especially since we now have fights in our name a military instrument, the United States Armed Forces today, that is extraordinarily powerful, but whose use does not weigh upon us the way it probably should. So I will stop there, and then I believe we're going to pass to some conversation, but thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, David Kennedy, Professor Emeritus at Stanford University and author of the new book, The Modern American Military. We have a number of really good audience questions, and why don't we start out with this one that kind of goes right to a bottom line, Professor. What change would you like to see come about as a result of your book?
Well, I'll give you a fuzzy answer first. I'd like people to pay attention to the military, who's in it, and what it does and how it does it. But there are more serious answers than that, although I think that's foundational and underlies everything. But I would like to see a set of changes whereby civil society becomes more engaged with the decision to shoulder arms and exert coercive power in the world. One of them, the most obvious place it seems to me to begin that discussion or start thinking about that is in the Congress. There was a commission co-chaired by James Baker and Warren Christopher, both of them former secretaries of state, Baker Republican, Christopher now deceased, a Democrat. It was called the National War Powers Commission. It gathered data and opinion and so on and reported in 2008. And amongst their principal recommendations was to revisit the War Powers Act of 1973, which, again, to simplify a fairly complicated piece of legislation, but in its essence, the War Powers Act of 1973 required the president to notify the Congress after the decision to deploy military force had been issued and to receive congressional approval within 60 days or 90 days under some circumstances. The very simple change that the War Powers Commission recommended in 2008 was that the president be obliged to consult with a special joint committee of Congress, not with all 535 people, but with a special joint committee before the military deployment was actually ordered and enacted. And the requirement was merely to consult, not necessarily to get statutory approval, simply to consult. So it's a modest step, but it does engage the people's representative body, the Congress of the United States, in the decision in a way that should conduce to more political engagement and political awareness of how the force is used. So that's one thing. A second thing that could happen in the Congress, it seems to me, if the Congress ever behaved itself, would be to end the practice of, end the practice of financing wars almost entirely on debt. If it were a statutory requirement that any large-scale military deployment, there'd have to be some effort given to defining large scale, but if there were any large-scale military deployment authorized by Congress, there would at least a fraction, again, you could argue what the fraction should be, of its projected or anticipated cost should take the form of a special tax levied on the population as a whole. Again, that would bring the fiscal burden home and make it felt in real time and would serve, I think, to direct the public's attention to the gravity and implications of these kinds of decisions.
You mentioned the proliferation of U.S. involvement around the world in the past few decades. A lot of that since the War Powers Act of 1973 took effect. What happened? How has it come to be that it's become so widely ignored for the most part?
Well, first of all, the War Powers Act, some people in this room might recollect, passed over President Nixon's veto. It was in the immediate wake of the conclusion of the Vietnam War, a time when the Congress and the country, and indeed the senior military leadership by that time, had become extremely disillusioned with the capacity of two or maybe three presidents, Nixon, Johnson, possibly Kennedy as well, their capacity to make big military commitments without really thinking through their longer-term implications and their burden on society. So the War Powers Act was a response to that particular historical moment. Nixon vetoed it, passed over his veto. Every president since, when asked, has denied its constitutionality because the commander-in-chief doesn't really welcome that kind of constriction on his freedom of action. And it has never been tested in the courts. So it's a pretty weak, and people who know more about this than I say, a pretty badly crafted piece of legislation, and it probably deserves to be revisited on all kinds of grounds. But look, you know, you make the point, John, that there have been this escalating number of deployments since 1973, 73. On the face of it, that just tells us we have a very poor mechanism in place for the exercise of the usual institutions of democratic deliberation and engagement when it comes to waging war. This has a much longer history, this particularly troublesome matter, and it goes back to the Constitution itself. Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 11 in the Constitution designates the Congress as the entity that has the authority and the responsibility to declare war. Article 2 nominates or designates the president as the commander-in-chief. And this division of responsibility between commander-in-chief and the authority to declare war has been around for over 200 years. It's built into the nature of the Constitution. The great constitutional scholar Edwin Corwin said years ago that that simple arrangement, it's part of the greater apparatus of checks and balances, of course. He said that was an invitation to conflict, and the conflict has gone on for two centuries between President and Congress. As I say, on the face of it, I think we have a very deficient mechanism for introducing proper deliberation and congressional involvement in these decisions.
It seems like neither branch of government really wants to fulfill its role there. The president does not necessarily want to defer to Congress, and as we saw, particularly after 9/11, with the use of force authorization, which was very generally drawn, that neither has really stepped up and fulfilled their role.
This is maybe a particular historical moment when you get a lot of agreement to the statement that Congress is not known for his courage. But you could probably extend that back beyond the current moment. But here's another set of number that, again, reminds us of the depth and magnitude of this issue about Congress and war-making power. So Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 11 says the Congress has the power to declare war. How many times in the 200-plus years of American history has Congress authorized that constitutional prerogative? The actual number is surprising. It's 5 times. Congress has done things like the authorization to use force in 2001 or the famous or fabled or notorious Gulf of Tonkin resolution, for example. But formal declaration of war only 5 times. War of 1812, Mexican War, Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II. So in general, Congress has really not been eager to play its constitutional role. In fact, in every one of the cases I've just named, the Congress responded to a presidential request for a declaration of war. So the president remains the principal actor in this drama. And though the Constitution assigns this role to Congress to declare war formally, it's only been done 5 times. You can have an interesting parlor game when you go home with your friends and family and neighbors asking that question. When I ask the question to virtually any audience, students or whatever, how many times has the Congress declared war? People will argue 20, 30, 40. I mean, they get the numbers all wrong. There was a Congressional Research Service survey commissioned by the United States Navy about 4 or 5 years ago. And it asked simply, since 1789, since we set up shop under the Constitution, how many overseas deployments have there been? And the answer was nearly 400. So 5 formal declarations of war and almost 400 deployments over 2 centuries. Again, the numbers on the face of it suggest that there's something deficient in the mechanisms we have.
I think this audience is going to be deadly in the next few days in terms of cocktail parties and around the water cooler with that one. Here's another audience question. How do you think things would be different in recent history if the United States had not moved to an all-volunteer force? What would have been the implications?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, this is one of these counterfactual scenarios, as historians like to say. And we're always wary when we confront one of these. But one thing I believe that would be different, let me say, just back up a step, that historically, at that moment in 1973, the armed forces were very wary of the transition to an all-volunteer force. The forces they knew, for simplicity's sake, I'll say the Army, which is the biggest force demographically, force they knew and had grown up with and knew how to run, had been a conscript force since 1940. And indeed, there have been episodes of conscription earlier in American history, World War I and so on. So they were wary of what this might mean because they were looking at a volunteer force that had to be of a sufficient size and proficiency not just to undertake constabulary duties or fight Indian wars out in the prairies and the plains, but to assume these global responsibilities that have become part of national security policy since World War II. So they didn't think an all-volunteer force could do it. But they very quickly, relatively quickly, came to love the all-volunteer force. The military leadership today is absolutely wedded to it in terms, strictly in terms of the quality of the force, and keeping people in service long enough to train them in these modern weapon systems, and recruiting people who have the wherewithal to do that kind of thing. So a lot of discipline problems that were god-awful in the Vietnam era are much less acute today. It's a much more professional force. It is a standing army, just to use the old-fashioned term for it. So they now love it. Okay, so what would be different if we hadn't done it? Well, we probably would have gone on with a force that was a little less resilient in terms of its capacity to adapt these modern weapon systems. There would have been some movement in that direction, to be sure, these information technologies and so on. But the force, a conscript force, would probably have been less resiliently able to make that transition as fast as the volunteer force did. But more importantly, I'll go back to the major point I was trying to make a few minutes ago, that a conscript force would have the effect of exposing millions of American households to the prospect that somebody in their family would be involuntarily taken into the armed services, and that's a way to focus public attention on national security policy, the decision to go to war, and what the armed forces are doing. So we've lost that.
A reminder to our broadcast audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest tonight is renowned Stanford University historian David Kennedy, discussing the changes and challenges confronting the modern American military. I'm John Diaz, the moderator for tonight. Another audience question on the point that you made, that when you look at this nation's elite, whether it's in military or in the political realm, how few of their children are actually serving. Why is that? I mean, these are men and women who are committed to the nation, yet you don't see that kind of public service.
Well, first of all, let it be said, there are exceptions to that statement. It's an accurate statement, I believe, in general. But there are exceptions. People who, to use your term, would be recognizable as the elite or the privileged in our society, whose children are in service. So let's acknowledge that, first of all. But it's also the case, this is one of these extraordinary characteristics of the times we live in. We have good opinion poll data about how the public, that's us, what we think of our institutions. Across the board, what we think of our churches, the media, professional sports, the Boy Scouts, you name it. And in virtually every single case measured against, let's say, take a benchmark, 1960 roughly, but we have data over all this period since then. But let's just benchmark it to 1960. With respect to virtually every institution in our society, we as a people think less of these institutions and their leadership. And I dare say, with good reason. This isn't just a random fact we can't explain. We all understand in our guts why we don't think as highly of our institutions and our leadership as we once did. But the Congress of the United States, its approval rating, I think, is in the single digits or in the teens. I mean, it's just ridiculous compared to historical data. There's one exception to what I just said, and it's the military. The military is the one institution in our society today that is the most respected, and people defer to the military. We've all seen it in places like airports and train stations and so on, civilians going up to people in uniform, thanking them for their service, buying them a drink, buying them a meal, handing them cash. Happens all the time. I mean, we treat our people in uniform the way people in other societies treat Buddhist monks. There's a lot of deference to them and a lot of admiration for them. So this is extraordinary. Again, those people in this room who lived through the Vietnam era will remember what the reputation or public posture of the military was at that time. Though it's probably apocryphal that returning veterans from Vietnam were spat upon. There's little, if any, really documented proof that happened. But as a metaphor for what a lot of the public thought of the military by that time, it's reasonably accurate.
And today is a sea change. And I don't begrudge the military the admiration that they command. I think they deserve it, and I share in that. But a society that trusts only one institution, which happens to be the military, I think is a society that really needs to look into its heart and ask itself, what's happened?
Here's a question, speaking, let's continue on that thought of the changing composition of the military. What do you foresee as the changing role of women in the military? And for that matter, how do you think that may reshape the military's culture?
Well, I'll tell you a little anecdote about this, by way of answering your question. In the version of this collection of essays that appeared as a special edition of the journal Daedalus, the publication of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, one of my authors in that version of it was an Air Force colonel by the name of Martha McSally, who achieved a certain level of fame a decade plus ago when she was stationed in Saudi Arabia, and she sued the Defense Department for the right to not wear protective clothing when she went out in public off the base. So she was already trying to strike a blow for women's rights in the military. She later became a combat fighter pilot in Iraq, and not too long ago, a year or two ago, she actually ran for Congress. She ran for Gabby Gifford's seat in Arizona on the Republican ticket and lost. But she wrote an essay for me in that original version of the book, which was a blisteringly strong piece of advocacy for granting women all imaginable combat roles. I wanted her to say something a little more general about the whole range of issues of women in the military. She wasn't terribly interested in that, and then about the time we had to make a decision, she decided to run for Congress, so she doesn't appear in the book form. There's another essay in there by two sociologists, both of the women, as it happens, about this matter. But, as you may know, the Secretary of Defense recently issued an instruction to all branches of service that encouraged them to take it under their own discretion just how far they would go in making combat roles available to women. It was not an order to grant combat roles to women, but it gave the service chiefs a lot of discretion, and we're going to see more of that. And we're especially going to see it, I think, in terms of who operates weapons systems that are standoff systems, not actually in the line of enemy fire. Remotely piloted aircraft, for example, standoff stealth weapons, so-called, mostly delivered by air. There are going to be more women doing that kind of thing in the military. How many women there are going to be at the point of the spear and forward fire bases with the M-16s facing the enemy? That's, I think, a troublesome question that nobody has a very good answer to as yet. But that women are now a presence in the military, and that their numbers, or their relative numbers, their proportion will increase, I think, is all but certain. And this is going to drive questions about what their role is, and that'll get interfiled, you might say, with questions about what kind of weapon systems do we have, and what kind of tactical doctrines do we employ in the field, given the fact that X percent of our force is going to be female.
Certainly, there's been a great deal of attention recently in the news about the treatment of women in the military, particularly not only the number of sexual assaults, but how they are handled within the chain of command. Is there a concern there that may discourage young women from going into the military now that this has become so much out in the open and a concern all the way up to the President of the United States?
Well, it certainly can't help encourage women to join the military when they read in the public prints and over in the media these instances of sexual harassment and abuse. That's for sure. So, the military, in this and any other society at just about any moment in time that you could name, going back as far in the historical record as we can reach, has been a masculine institution. And by that I mean not simply that it's been mostly men who have done it, but the military has valorized and enhanced values of aggression and the kinds of things we don't typically associate with the feminine character, if there is such a thing as the feminine character. So the old cliche, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, I mean, that's a hugely oversimplified generalization. But there's enough to it that it reminds us of the real issues of integrating women into a force that has prided itself, not just the U.S. force, but I say all militaries going back through time, on enhancing and elevating values that are thought to be typically masculine, like aggression and the use of force and courage and so on, physical courage.
We had a couple audience questions related to your point that the U.S. military today is measured in various ways. It's relatively inexpensive. One of the questions dealt with the way we treat our returning veterans, particularly those who are wounded or have other issues. Is that really one of the hidden costs that this country is really not owned up to when you talk about how much we pay for our military?
Yeah, I think so. And again, people in this room and this audience might be familiar with some of the studies that were done actually several years ago at the onset of the Iraq and later Afghan wars by the economist, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. And he argued then, and I think it's probably a point still worth making, that the real-time costs that have been paid in the last few years vastly understate the true cost of the war because of all the things that go forward, interest on the debt that was incurred to pay for the war because we did not levy new taxes. In fact, we cut taxes going into Iraq. And, of course, you also rightly point out the costs of to the society at large of veterans and their care and well-being. And here there's a fiscal fact in all this, which I only learned in the course of putting this book together. But a lot of those costs are, especially for benefits for retired military personnel, are not put together on an accrual basis. They're all above the line in the annual Defense Department appropriations. So there are fixed costs going forward that will only grow, and that's part of the Stiglitz calculation of why the longer-term cost of the war is understated by current appropriations. So that I think, is a pretty important matter. Now, here's another dimension of this that is little understood, but I think is quite poignant, actually. And one of my authors, Jonathan Shea, the last essay in the book, the title of which is Casualties, brings this out. And he points out that if we had in place in Iraq the same battlefield medicine techniques that we had in Vietnam, which, as things go, isn't all that long ago, but if that's the way we treated wounded in the field, in the battle space, and so on, if we'd done it the same way in Iraq as we did in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, the death toll in Iraq would have been well over 20,000. In fact, it's well under 5,000. It's 4,000 and some. And it's because a lot of people who would have died in another circumstance, their lives were saved, but they were saved, many of them, in very damaged condition. Amputees, loss of organs, traumatic head injuries, especially prevalent thanks to IEDs, improvised explosive devices. So yes, we saved their lives, but we've also set them up, many of these people, and we should be thankful that their lives were spared, to be sure, but we've set them up, many of them, for a lifetime of dependency on the healthcare and medical care system to a degree that wasn't true in prior wars. So, and there's a political implication of those medical facts, it seems to me, which maybe is a little crude to state this way, but I'll do it anyway. And it is simply that mortality is politically loud. And again, if you remember those Life magazine articles back in the Vietnam era, when they would do these 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-page spreads, photographs of all the troops killed in Vietnam in the preceding week or month, hundreds of them sometimes. Those were loud statements. People paid attention, and it got the attention of the public focused on what was going on. The wounded they're just less loud. 4,000 deaths are loud, but not as loud as 20-some thousand. And one of the implications of these improved battlefield medicine techniques is there's a news item that is less powerful, less urgent in the eyes and ears of the public at large. So it's just another one of the many, many ways in which it's easier today not to pay attention than it was once upon a time.
What is your thought on the draft? Should we reinstate it?
Well, number one, we don't need a draft in the sense, well, let me back up. We don't need a draft on the scale of the drafts we had in the Vietnam or especially in the World War II era. 16 million people served in World War II, almost all of them conscripts, a great majority were conscripts. And if we had a proportionately sized army today to be 35 million people or so, we wouldn't know what to do with that. And we wouldn't know what to do with the withdrawal of that much energy from the civilian labor force. So we don't need a draft, a mass conscription army or force the way we once did. That's number one. Number two, and this is, I just have enough of the libertarian streak in me, I guess, it's just my personal belief that the state does not have and should not have the authority to compel people into, let's use the proper term for it, involuntary servitude. That used to be a synonym for slavery. Absent an existential threat to the very being of the society. If there is such a threat, yes, then I think the state does have the authority to command that degree of service. But absent that, I don't think so. So I'm just philosophically, I stop short of the idea of a full conscripted army. In a piece that one of my contributors, General Carl Eikenberry, and I did in the New York Times a week ago, toyed with the idea, that doesn't do us justice, but we hesitantly or tentatively proposed some kind of a draft system a lottery system that would be activated to populate the armed forces at the margins when the volunteer system broke down. It wouldn't be a large number, but it'd be some people who were there involuntarily. I'm not sure I really fully believe in this, but we said it anyway. And the idea would be that the lottery, the way it would work as we sort of thought it through, was that 18-year-olds would have to register for the draft, and then they would be in the lottery pool, let's say for 2 years or 3 years. Everyone would understand that statistically the probability of service was extremely low, but would not be zero. And that if volunteering did not fill out the ranks, then the lottery would be activated and at least some people would get drafted. And again, it's just one other way to think about how do you focus the attention of the public, civil society at large, on the military, who's in it, and what they do. So we put this forward with some hesitation and hedging our bets a bit, but that's about as much draft as I'm willing to get behind.
You make the point of the relative importance and prominence of technology in the modern military. How is it, and certainly during your talk you address how that is changing maybe the threshold for the political leadership, the civilian leadership to be willing to get involved in conflict. How is it changing the culture within the military?
Well, again, I'll respond in part at least with a personal story. A couple of months ago, I was a guest of former Secretary of Defense William Perry and General Eikenberry, for that matter, at Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada near Las Vegas and at a nearby base called Creech. And those two bases, Creech in particular, is where they train remotely piloted aircraft pilots. Again, they hate the word drone, so I'm trying not to use it, but we all know what I'm talking about. And shortly thereafter, I actually got to fly one of these remotely piloted aircrafts on the simulator, at least. It was like a big video game, you know. It's kind of fun in a sense. Don't misunderstand me, but there is a certain coolness to it, you know. And these young people they're all pretty young. They are pilots, and they think of themselves as warriors and in the battle space. So and shortly after this, within a week or two after our visit, the Pentagon announced the creation of a new military honor, a medal, to honor distinguished service amongst remotely piloted aircraft operators or pilots. And other branches of the service griped about this loudly, that these guys weren't real warriors because they were working out of air-conditioned trailers in southern Nevada and actually firing weapons 8,000 miles away. They did not deserve this kind of recognition. But the Pentagon, as I understand it, is sticking to the story that these are warriors and they are in the battle space, even if only virtually. Now, here's an interesting wrinkle to this. We were briefed down there that these pilots, most of them live in North Las Vegas, off the base in this case, or a lot of them live off the base, and they commute to Creech Air Force Base by automobile. Well, they used to commute by bus, by an Air Force bus that would bring them in uniform to the base every day. For security reasons, they've discontinued that practice, and these pilots are now instructed to wear civilian clothes, drive their own vehicles, and take different routes to the base every day because they fear reprisals in Nevada from whoever thinks themselves unfairly targeted by these remote devices out there in Yemen or Pakistan or Afghanistan or wherever it might be. So here's an interesting question that we put to the commanders down there, and they didn't have the answer. So what if, let's say, I'm going to speculate here, let's say a Yemeni soldier finds his way to Las Vegas, and he kills one or more remotely piloted aircraft operators down there, and then he's captured. And he claims the rights of a prisoner of war because he has killed an enemy in the battle space. Now, it's kind of creepy and weird to think about this scenario, but it's not altogether unimaginable. It's a low probability event, but not altogether unimaginable. So it's one way in which the weapon systems we have that we've developed present dilemmas and problems that traditional thinking just hasn't even begun to take on board.
It's almost axiomatic that generals are always preparing for the last war, to fight the last war. Of course, in fairness, that's also true in civilian life. We always tend to worry about preparing for the last crisis. But it raises the question, is it really possible or practical for this or any other country to anticipate what the challenge, what the threat may be in the future?
Well, no, it's not possible. I mean, in general, just as a philosophical proposition, the future is unknowable. I'm an historian. My life's work is all about getting data, getting as much data as is relevant, and trying to figure it out. We have no data from the future, by definition. We don't know what's going to happen.
I think Donald Rumsfeld had a line for that, the known unknowns.
Yeah, that was a pretty good line, actually. The unknown unknowns. You just don't know what you don't know. Though that was a kind of a rhetorical jumble, that statement, it actually, I think, got at something pretty real and kind of in a creative way. So all that said, what the national security apparatus, generals and others who work in that system, try to do, what they're tasked to do, is to try to guess and speculate about the future to the best of their ability and prepare us for it, and to prepare us to defend ourselves against whatever threats we've never seen before but might become imaginable over the horizon in the not-too-distant future. So they have to do that. Whether they get it right or not is another matter. And again, to quote another Rumsfeld dictum, you go to war with the army you have. You've tried to configure the force in a way that has anticipated the future, but if you don't get it right, you still have to use the force you have. And you might have the appropriate force or not. We had a wonderfully appropriate force in 2003 when it came to extinguishing Saddam Hussein's conventional forces in the field. The war was over in a matter of hours. And the conventional force that we faced was obliterated without any stint or let almost immediately. But that wasn't the war that we went on to fight. We went on to fight a counterinsurgency war, war amongst the people, as it's sometimes called, and that our force was not well configured or trained or prepared for that particular kind of conflict.
Fortunately, we're at the point here where we have time for one more question, and that deals with also outside influences on the military. What do you see as the effect of the military-industrial complex on what happens within the U.S. military?
Well, again, I think we have a lot of inherited ideas about the military-industrial complex that come down from that famous speech that Dwight Eisenhower gave in 1960 or 61, where he coined the phrase. And in the Cold War era, it was a kind of a staple item of concern that we had evolved a big economic interest in perpetual war in order to feed this industrial machine that was geared up to build weapon systems and so on. I think that's still a concern, but it's more dissipated. That is to say, there are congressional districts and states where this has a higher incidence than other places, and there are particular constituencies that have this kind of interest, and they're still very powerful. But the weight of the so-called military-industrial complex in the larger economy is not what it once was, because the whole system costs about half what it did in the Cold War period relative to GDP, about 4 or 5% GDP for the Pentagon budget. It used to be 8 to 10% or even 12% at the height of the Vietnam War. And in fact, there are some voices out there that worry that we've boiled the whole industrial complex down to a small enough number of industries that their only client is the federal government, and we haven't sufficiently diversified the playing field so that we have more resilience and creativity and entrepreneurship in that realm.
Please join me in thanking David Kennedy, Stanford University Professor Emeritus of History and the author of the new book, The Modern American Military. Also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. Also want to remind everybody here that copies of Professor Kennedy's new book are on sale in the lobby. He will be pleased to sign them outside the room following the program, but please, please give him a chance to make his way back to the room so he can do those signings. I am John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.